Welcome to Season 2 of The Wayfarer's Guide to World Building, a podcast for writers by Mythos & Inc. Publishing. I'm Kyle.
I'm Emma.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Christiana.
Welcome, listeners, new and old, to The Wayfarer's Guide to World Building. Special thanks to our patron, Jordan Phillips, for making this episode possible. If you are a patron, send us your world building, writing, or publishing questions for us to answer in our bonus Q&A episodes. The theme is tropes in this season of the podcast, common themes and plot elements that readers know and love or hate. Today's trope, who wants to live forever, aka immortal magics and technology. Some characters are driven to find a way to live forever and go on a quest for eternal life, but often when they do snag that elixir of life or that fountain of youth or that tech that lets you upload your consciousness into a new body, they find immortality isn't all it's cracked up to be. We're going to look at how some writers have played with this trope in interesting ways. I'm Allison Alexander, she, her, editorial director at Mythos & Inc., and with me today...
I'm Christiana, they, them, public relations director at Mythos & Inc.
And I'm Kyle Rudge, he, him, business and marketing director at Mythos & Inc.
Kyle, start us off today.
I'm first. It's up to me. My example comes from Prime Video. It's this gem of a show that, correct me if I'm wrong, Allison, you recommended to me. It was called Upload.
That sounds familiar.
The premise of the show, it's a sci-fi dramedy where the technology exists that before you die, you can choose to basically die prematurely and have your consciousness permanently uploaded to this afterlife where you can essentially live for eternity.
Right.
However, not all people are equal in the afterlife. The afterlife requires an investment. So the wealthy can live with far more freedom at lakeside villas in the afterlife, doing all of the things they love to do in the real world, and now they can do them forever in eternity. While the poor are relegated to only being online for maybe a few hours a month and kind of rest in these plain white rooms with very little to actually do and seems very depressing for all eternity. In the story, our main character has a relatively benign traffic accident. However, in the pressure of him being in the hospital, these doctors claiming that he was seemingly going to die, that he had to or he should sign over his life to the afterlife, in which he's unceremoniously executed and now lives in the afterlife, funded by his very wealthy, still living girlfriend who holds hostage his freedom in the afterlife. Now, it's really good world building because it takes this very real world problem of economic insecurity slash the diversity and very much high class and low class in those things, and amplifies it to a literal infinity through the afterlife. It's comedic in its absurdity and gives us a very real basis to discuss this real economic class system that exists in our present day society.
I remember this show being confused about whether it was trying to be a drama or a comedy, because it seemed to be trying to do both things. And I wondered what you thought of that, Kyle.
Well, that's why I called it a dramedy. And I would agree that it started off as being, because in the afterlife, we would encounter glitches and like weird customer support responses. And just the oddness of it all would be comedy. But then at around the halfway to two-thirds point, it switches where he realizes that maybe he was murdered. Maybe he was pressured into because some of his real life memories no longer exist when they should have. And there's some inconsistencies and things feel weird. And so then I think it really starts to unfold more as a drama than a comedy. So I think it kind of has that shift in tone when that happens. And I think that shift in tone is the only reason they got a second season extended. So I'm excited to see where it goes.
Oh, yes. So maybe it works better as a drama than as a comedy.
I think so. That to me, what it sounds like is they had a focus group and they were done with the weird glitchy comedy and decided to go that way. That was maybe, who knows.
So I have a bunch of questions about how this world works.
Bring it on.
So since he has a still alive girlfriend, can they communicate in some way? Like, are the people in the afterlife able to communicate with the living?
So what's interesting is that they actually have, there's this scene where he has the funeral, like his own funeral, and everybody's there in this very clean, I guess it would be a church, and his body without a head, because your head has to be completely vaporized in order for this upload to happen.
Oh.
So his body is there in a coffin, and then there's this full screen wall that is just like a computer monitor, and he's there, and it's almost like this virtual reality in which they can speak to one another. And in addition, she can put on a VR suit to enter into the afterlife to be with him. But there's also complications with that, and it's not perfect. And I mean, it's very controlling, because it's kind of one-sided, where one has freedom and one does not.
Yeah. Okay. And so this technology, is it like proprietary? Is there one big evil corporation running this, making all the money?
Yes. And so I think that's actually where the drama part comes in. So the plot is that there is one company that does this, and they bill themselves as incredibly benevolent. But of course, in the reality of it is that, right, there's this huge economic diversity where the poor live in squalors for eternity, and there's nothing really joyous or happy about that, whereas the wealthy are allowed to exploit. So this guy who gets murdered, essentially, he was inventing an open source or free version of an afterlife for everybody.
I've forgotten all these details.
Yeah. And so we start to learn that maybe that's why
political intrigue.
Yeah.
So,
good question.
Well, this reminds me of, did you watch Facebook's rebranding launch with the metaverse that he wants to create?
I haven't seen that.
I watched the Late Show's commentary on it, and I was like, I don't think I could make it through. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much that Zuckerberg wants to create a augmented reality world where you can work remotely, shop virtually. Like, you wake up in the morning, you put on your headset, you exist in the headset all day, kind of thing. Which gives me all kind of ickies, and hearing this story gives me even more ickies thinking about it.
I mean, as a person coming at this from like a disabled perspective, I'm thinking that could be valuable.
I think it
section of the population.
Could be if it wasn't Facebook.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I like
me. The
yeah, where I like the idea it's, of it, but I'm not sure if I like who's doing it.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, Christiana, what do you got?
So mine is very much not techie. Mine is good old fashioned vampires.
Of course.
Specifically, though, Claudia from Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's no surprise I pick vampires. From age 4 to 12, I was Dracula every single Halloween, and I would wear a tuxedo, and my mom would paint a widow's peak on my head and fake blood and the whole shebang. So obviously I went with vampires, and their immortality differs a lot from story to story. But in Anne Rice's The Vampire Chronicles, it's very classic vampires. Vampire turns you can't go out in the sun, they sleep in coffins. Very baseline vampire mythology. But Claudia specifically, she's found by two vampires, Louis and Lestat, or Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise, if you will. And she's turned when she's only 5 years old. So at first they live in harmony in a weird but loving relationship, but she starts to slowly grow resentful towards them, because she's maturing mentally and becomes quite the scholar, but she's trapped in the body of a five-year-old.
Hmm.
So she hates Lestat for turning her, and all she wants to do is grow up and be a woman, because mentally she's a woman, but she's trapped in a five-year-old body. And she's not just trapped in a five-year-old body, but she's trapped in a five-year-old body forever. And the only way to escape it is death, and the classic death for vampires being exposed to direct sunlight. Without spoiling a classic story, in case you haven't watched it, this does eventually happen against her will. It's very sad, but it's like the slight release that at least she's no longer trapped in this body. And I think this is a really good example of world building, because it shows how facets of a world can be great for some people and torment for others. And on a personal note, dealing with chronic illness and a disability, mm-hmm. I find myself very drawn to her character recently because that feeling of being trapped in your body can be very real some days, which I think brings another interesting element to the concept of immortality, because maybe after a while, the body will start to feel like a prison because not every immortal wants to be immortal, especially when you're trapped in a body that you don't feel fits you.
Mm.
See, that was going to be my question. It was exactly that. was this idea of like physical disability and I'm knowing my own body of, you know, every year it feels like something else hurts or something else is broken, and feeling that like at what point is it going to be too much for me? Like, where is my where is my limit where I start to get into depression or mental health mm-hmm. issues as a result of all of these things? When it comes to Claudia in that, what are some of the relationships she has outside of Lewis and Lestat that help her develop as a person and mature as an individual?
She doesn't really have many, and that's part of the problem.
Mm.
So since they're vampires, they keep to themselves. They're only out at night, right? So that obviously complicates things. But there's also not a lot of vampires around, and it's been a while since I've read the book. But if I recall correctly, like eventually they travel to Europe and they're disgusted by all the vampires there because they view them as like these animals that just run around eating people and there's no sophistication kind of thing. And they become really resentful until eventually I think they meet one, but he ends up being the master of her demise. So that doesn't help. But she's under the tutelage of Lestat, Lestat for the majority of it. And he's the one who kind of teaches her everything because he's very, very old and gives her all the books and helps her study and stuff. But that's also kind of part of the resentment, is not only does she want to be a woman, she wants to be grown, she wants to have all these experiences, but she also just wants to not just hang out with her gay vampire dads all day. She wants a life outside of that. So
do the two adult vampires, do they sort of represent the opposite side of the coin? How do they feel about their immortality?
Lestat, not in this book, but Lestat is loving it. And the vampire Lestat, the second book in the Chronicles, I think, he like becomes a rock star and he's living it up. Uh-huh. So I think Louis has like a slightly more complicated thing. I'm not sure. Can't remember. It's been a while. I don't remember him distinctly loving it or hating it, but Lestat definitely loved it.
That's really neat to see all the different opinions in one story. Because often I feel like it's one or the other, but I like that.
Yeah.
My example is from Mistborn by Brandon Sanderson. And
I mean, of course it's going to be Brandon Sanderson.
And spoilers for the ending of the first Mistborn book. So you've been warned, this is like the big reveal at the end of the first book. So skip ahead if you don't want to hear this. What I love most about Brandon Sanderson's writing is he has this way of dribbling tidbits of world building slowly throughout a story and then having it all come together in an interesting reveal at the end. Like all the books that I've read by him do this. In the case of Mistborn, the immortality is distinctly tied to the magic systems, because of course it is, it's Brandon Sanderson. So in the first book, we learn about two types of magic. The first is allomancy, in which people can use magic by ingesting metals, and depending on the type of allomancer and the metal they ingested, they can burn the metal to do something specific. So for example, people who have the ability to burn steel could push on nearby metals, so they could cause a coin to fly away from themselves. People who burn iron can pull on nearby metals, so they could cause a coin to fly towards themselves. People who burn tin get enhanced senses. People who burn zinc can inflame others' emotions, etc. True to Brandon Sanderson, this is a really complex system with lots of metals and information that slowly gets revealed throughout the story. I could go on and on about it, but we'll stop there. That's the basics. The second type of magic is ferrochemy. I think I'm saying that right. Ferrochemy?
Sure.
Ferrochemists also have the ability to use metal, but they use it differently than allomancers. They can use a metal to store up power over time and then use it later. So, for example, you can lessen the size of your muscles for a while, spend some time as a weakling to store strength in pewter, and then access it later, become like a super strong person later. You can store memories in copper, speed in steel, etc. So as you're reading the novel, you become aware of the different magic types and the people who use them, and that there are very few fair chemists because the Lord Ruler, the story's villain, has hunted them all down for unknown reasons. You also know that the Lord Ruler is immortal, but no one knows how. The ending reveals that the Lord Ruler is both a fair chemist and an allomancer, really, really rare, and this is the source of his immortality. Rare metal adium stores age, so a fair chemist could become older now in exchange for becoming younger later, and normally this would be an equivalent exchange, but as an allomancer, he can burn the metal he has stored the youth in, effectively making a profit on the attribute stored there. This is all very complex. Ooh. Because Brandon Sanderson and magic systems. But I think this is good world building because it expands on details we have learned, and the Lord Ruler's immortality is almost an equation that we could have figured out earlier and guessed, but not really. And it's a fun aha moment in which immortality is not just granted by a magical or technological item, but as a result of magic combined. So I found that really cool.
When the reveal happened that the Lord Ruler was both a ferrochemist and an allomancer, did it suddenly make sense? Like, oh, you know, like all of the things that were going on, this is why he lives. Okay, everything kind of lines up. Or did it still also kind of have to be explained throughout it?
It kind of made sense, but it's kind of like the ending of an Agatha Christie novel. It's like, oh, I should have guessed that, except you never really guess it. Like, it's always so well hidden and you never really could have guessed it, but sort of, but you feel like you could have. So that feeling of, of course, is still there, which I really like.
Were there ever any rumors as to why the Lord Ruler was, you know what I mean? Like false leads or things like that in the story that tried to lead you astray?
Somehow Brandon Sanderson wrote it in such a way that you never really thought about these two magical powers being combined. And I'm not sure how he managed that, but it was just like, you know, you're either an allomancer or you're a fair chemist. You're not both. That just isn't a thing. So I'm not entirely, I'd have to read it through again and to really think about that question to figure out how he managed to do that.
I just want to say, I haven't read this book and I love how ridiculously straightforward Lord Ruler is.
Right?
That's really, you're like, that's the bad guy. The Lord that Ruler. Guy right there. Yeah,
that's him.
Get him. is there, sure. Can you combine metals at once? Like, can I eat a penny and a nickel? You know what I mean?
Yeah, so the Mistborn are people who have all of the metal powers. And so they will have like a little vial with like little beads of each metal, and they'll swallow all of them at once. And then they'll slowly run out as they use it. And then Mistborn are really rare, and most people can only do one thing. So they'll have their little bead of copper or whatever it is that they can actually use and will swallow it.
Gotcha.
So yeah, it's a really interesting system because you have to be swallowing these metals all the time and have access to them. And
so is the Lord Ruler a Mistborn as well as a ferrochemist?
Yes. I think he has to be for some reason. Or does he only have to be able to use adium? Whatever. He is a Mistborn, so he can use all the metals, and he can also use the ferrochemy.
I think that's also, it kind of ties into the trope of the chosen one, but he's like the chosen one, because it's like, at first when you're describing him, I was like, okay, so he's the chosen one, the one guy who can use all magic.
Yeah,
which I feel like comes up in stories that revolve magic every so often kind of thing.
In the story, he's supposed to be the one to have saved the world. Like, he is the chosen one, but then he was evil. And he turned evil. So it wasn't good.
Yeah. But then there's also the Mistborn, which kind of feel like a chosen one trope as well. So he's double
tropes
chosen
on tropes
one.
On tropes.
Yeah.
Tropes on tropes on tropes.
So we've got a couple announcements before we get to the questions you should ask yourself if you decide to play with this trope in your novel. If you think this podcast is at least a dollar's worth of education and entertainment, consider supporting the show through Patreon at patreon.com/mythosandinc. Patrons at the Kieran level can receive query critiques from our editors and or evaluations of their website and social media presence from our marketing team. So please help us keep the podcast going, and we will send you all our love and appreciation.
Using the magic of technology to pause time for just a moment here to ask a really important favor. If you're enjoying this podcast and want to hear more of it, the most helpful thing you can do is to write us a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our podcast. Positive reviews are the number one way for a new podcast to get more listeners, which in turn will let us do all sorts of cool things like transcribe all our episodes and from recording bi-weekly to maybe even weekly. You can go leave us one right now. I promise I'll keep time paused until you get back.
What should you ask yourself if you have immortal magic or technology in your novel?
I'm first. For me, I would think, what societal or even economic problems does immortality create in your society? Mm-hmm. If someone can live forever, can they invest a penny in the 1900s and suddenly be super, super wealthy in the 2000s? Or what? What is the visceral impact it would have on a society like that? How does that culture play into the story as a whole?
My question would be, do they want to be immortal? Is it a blessing or a curse? Are there physical ramifications to immortality? Are they forever young? Is it like Picture of Dorian Gray? I would consider those things instead of just blanket immortality.
Dorian Gray was going to be my second choice of examples.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good one.
Can you achieve a surprise moment about how immortality is gained? Brandon Sanderson does this through an intricate magic system, but you can also play with the costs of immortality, similar to what Christiana was saying. Play with the repercussions in interesting ways. Immortality shouldn't just be rainbows and unicorns, probably, in reality. Yes. I think it'll be more complicated.
If everyone were immortal, it would be glorious. There'd be no death. It'd be wonderful. Sure.
Perfect society.
Just like
there's
the good
place. Actually a book about that. A fairly old young adult book called The Declaration. And it's about they find pills to make everyone live forever. And overpopulation becomes a problem. And how do you think they deal with that? So.
Sounds very.
It's how Lord of the Flies began.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The hosts of the Wayfarer's Guide to World Building are also staff at Mythos & Inc. Publishing, where we publish books for geeks by geeks. At the end of each podcast episode, we give you a little insight into the world of book publishing by sharing what we've been up to. Christiana, what have you been up to?
So we're ramping up for the release of Myths and Magic and Voice of the Banished. So marketing means coming up with a lot of different schemes to get these books in your hands.
Ooh, what about you, Kyle?
For me, well, we're just wrapping up some of our Thy Geekdom Come 1 and 2 giveaways that we've been doing with various influencers, which I'm really excited about. And yeah, other than that, I'm just preparing for Christmas. I'm very excited. I love this holiday. It's presents. It's me.
I like giving presents almost more than getting them. I just like trying to figure out what people want.
This is why we're friends.
Yes, of course it is. No, I like getting presents too. Let's be real. I am working in related news to Christiana's on the finishing touches to Making Myths and Magic. That's our sci-fi and fantasy writing guide that I'm writing with Shelley Campbell. And we got our beta comments back. And so I've been going through those and just doing small tweaks and changes and making it all perfect for you readers. And it's exciting. I'm so excited to release this book. We've been talking about it for a long time and it's almost time. It's almost release time. 2 more months. So
exciting. Yay.
Yeah. If you are looking for a sci-fi and fantasy writing community on Discord, go to mythosinc.com and join ours. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, email us at podcast@mythosinc.com or tweet to us at @mythosinc. We always love hearing from our listeners. Until next time, fellow wayfarers, go build worlds.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.